Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning we take a look at Umpqua Community College and the surrounding communities 1 week after the tragic shooting. Classes will resume next Monday. President Obama will visit with families tomorrow. We'll hear about that in just a few minutes. But first, we're familiar with the story of the Minnesota dentist who became notorious for killing Cecil the Lion, spurring international outrage. The killing of, importing, and trafficking in endangered species and products creates conflict all over the world as cultures clash with big bucks. Commercial imports of ivory, for example, have been banned by federal and international law for decades. Activists are pressing West Coast states to pass their own laws to deter the poaching of elephants and rhinos. Correspondent Tom Bonsi looked into how the American West and endangered African wildlife intersect.
Here's the scene. An air cargo warehouse near SeaTac International Airport earlier this month. A quartet of special agents and wildlife inspectors from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service arrive. No guns in hand, rather handbooks on African wildlife and power screwdrivers. The federal agents want to look inside several wooden crates.
He's got a lot of stuff in it.
The manifests say the crates contain trophies from big game hunts in southern Africa.
So this is ivory.
In this case, it's okay, though, says Supervisory Inspector John Goldman, because the tusk belongs to a warthog skull. That's not a protected species.
This would be difficult to confuse with elephant ivory.
That's Special Agent in Charge Eric Merrick. He says contraband does pass through the Northwest. Last year, the service busted an antique dealer who attempted to smuggle rhino horns from the U.S. to suburban Vancouver, Canada, through an address in Point Roberts, Washington. Goldman recalls one seizure of ivory jewelry in Portland in the last 3 years. The Seattle-Tacoma seaport and airport and Washington and Idaho's northern border combined average about 3 to 4 interceptions per year. That's of elephant ivory jewelry or carvings or an improperly imported sport-hunted elephant trophy.
Yeah, it's not very often that we're finding it, yeah.
But Goldman says there's ample reason to believe this is a legitimate problem.
We're arguably the fourth largest seaport. Okay, it's a growing airport, it's a growing region, it's a tremendous affluence here, and all of these things are all point to the potential for greater illegal imports of wildlife and exports.
So it's an issue with federal laws to address it and inspectors who don't find elephant or rhino products very often. Why then do groups such as the Humane Society of the U.S., Wildlife Conservation Society, NRDC, and others want new state laws against it? The Humane Society's Jennifer Hillman says it's about sending a message.
Having that much deeper level of enforcement at the state level is going to help overall with the trafficking that's happening intrastate.
And that's exactly what California is set to do now that Governor Jerry Brown has signed a new law banning the sale of ivory or rhino horns in his state. The Oregon and Washington legislatures considered similar measures during their sessions earlier this year, but those didn't pass. So now wildlife advocates are going straight to the voters, this November in Washington and probably next November in Oregon. None of the proposed state laws include additional money for enforcement, though. Seattle Seahawks and Portland Trailblazers owner Paul Allen bankrolled the successful initiative petition drive in Washington. Initiative 1401 would criminalize under state law trafficking in 10 species of endangered wildlife.
The truth is that poaching in Africa cannot be stopped by a Washington state initiative. The controlling laws would be the laws of the countries themselves.
Stuart Halzen is an antique collector and lobbyist from Centralia, Washington. He looks directly into the camera in a video voter's guide statement and declares the state ballot measure would make innocent people into criminals.
Demonizing people who own legal ivory antiques from before its importation was made illegal is not an effective or even rational strategy to combat poaching in Africa. It wouldn't work, and it would make legal antiques worthless.
At present, you can legally sell vintage African elephant ivory if you can document that it arrived in this country before 1990. Wildlife advocates make no bones about seeking a broad ban on ivory sales, no matter its provenance. They argue the legal ivory trade provides cover for sales of illegal trinkets and carvings. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Recent investigations of elephant and rhino poaching in Africa attribute the upsurge in trafficking to demand from China and neighboring Southeast Asian countries. Opponents of state legislation urged in Olympia earlier this year that sales in the United States do not materially contribute to the illegal ivory trade. But wildlife advocacy groups assert the U.S. has one of the biggest markets in the world for ivory, illegal and legal, and that ending demand at home is a key to stopping the slaughter of elephants abroad. Washington Initiative 1401 is bankrolled by billionaire Paul Allen and will be considered by voters next month. A ballot measure in Oregon that would criminalize trafficking in endangered wildlife is in the works, and a new law in California bans all ivory trade. Umpqua Community College reopened Monday to employees and students for the first time since a gunman killed 9 people there last Thursday. Class won't resume until Monday, October 12th, but the school is providing grief counseling to staff and students. Meanwhile, some Southwest Oregon gun owners say they're worried that the Roseburg shootings will spur lawmakers to pass more gun laws. Several people at a gun show in Grants Pass Sunday said the attack shouldn't be used for political reasons. Reporter Chris Lehman spoke with Wayne Barnett of Grants Pass, one of those looking at guns at the show. Barnett said he fears what he called an erosion of the Second Amendment.
States seem to be wanting to override that and putting all sorts of regulations on that amendment itself. My question would be to the lawmakers, what right do you have to amend the federal Constitution?
Officials say they recovered 14 firearms owned by the alleged gunman in the Umpqua shootings. They say all of them were obtained legally. Meanwhile, gun sales have been rising in Roseburg. As a result of last week's shooting, people are arming themselves.
Local gun owners here in Roseburg say that handgun sales have gone through the roof since the UCC shooting. They say that many of their customers are concerned of copycat shootings and that their customers believe that the only way to stop a shooting like that is to have other people who are armed to take down the gunman. Speaking of that gunman, the ATF has recovered 13 weapons that he owned. The ATF has confirmed that several of them were purchased locally here in Roseburg, and ATF officers have contacted all gun shop owners in the area to match up serial numbers.
President Obama travels to Roseburg tomorrow to meet privately with the victims' families who died in last week's shooting. The politics surrounding gun violence began almost immediately after the tragedy at UCC. Federal officials say the weapons used in the shooting were purchased legally, raising questions about what more could be done to prevent mass killings. Conrad Wilson reports.
Law enforcement officials say the weapons used by Chris Harper Mercer in last week's shooting at Umpqua Community College were lawfully purchased.
They were all purchased legally, yes.
Salinas Nunez is the assistant special agent in charge for the Seattle Field Division of the ATF. She told reporters at a press conference in Roseburg last week that more than a dozen guns were found at the community college and the shooter's apartment.
7 have been purchased by the shooter or a family member, all within the last 3 years.
Nunez says all the weapons can be traced back to a federal firearms dealer. Oregon law requires anyone who wants to purchase a firearm to pass a background check performed by the Oregon State Police. Officers check for felons, domestic abusers, and those who have been deemed mentally ill by the courts. In May, Governor Kate Brown signed the Oregon Firearms Safety Act. The legislation expanded background checks from firearm dealers to include person-to-person sales. At the bill signing ceremony, Governor Brown called the law an important step towards keeping guns out of the hands of criminals.
Oregon State Police data on gun transactions indicates that in the month of March alone, 193 people tried to buy guns in this state who were prohibited by law from having them, most of them convicted felons.
That same data showed more than 240,000 background checks for gun transactions since September of last year. Fewer than 1% of those were denied and ended up being investigated. OSP did not return requests for comment. What those numbers mean is the subject of debate. Ron Louie is the former chief of police for the city of Hillsboro and now teaches criminal justice at Portland State University.
And the other 99%, are there people within that pool that perhaps should not own a gun but somehow have legally complied with the rules, so to speak? That's speculation, and I just don't know.
Would Oregon's new law have prevented the shooter from purchasing guns in the state?
I don't believe so.
Louie's in the camp that says more needs to be done to prevent guns from ending up in the hands of those wishing to do harm. But he's not in favor of expanding background checks to include things such as checking someone's social media profile.
The best way to do it is a loved one or a concerned person comes forward to identify somebody that may be potential and look at how much we should do about that, understanding we still have a Constitution and our blessed civil liberties.
But others argue there are too many laws regulating guns and say more won't help.
We pass laws because it makes somebody feel good, not because it makes any sense.
Kevin Sterrett is the director of the Oregon Firearms Federation, a self-described Second Amendment advocacy organization.
They don't work. We have a lot of gun laws. We have laws that are contradictory. We have laws that literally make no sense, laughably make no sense.
Since the mass shooting in Roseburg, concerns about potential violent attacks have disrupted classes at schools across Oregon. On Friday, Southwest Oregon Community College and schools in the Cloquel School District closed due to a reported threat. It was later discounted by law enforcement. And just yesterday, police evacuated Rogue Community College in Grants Pass due to a possible bomb threat. I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
And in Douglas County, grief counselors have been encouraging people to stick to their normal routines. For some, that meant going to the Friday night football game. Head coach Steve Stebbins says he struggled with the decision to go forward with the game. 18-year-old Rebecca Ann Carnes, who had just graduated from South Umpqua High, was among those killed on Thursday.
Our whole mission tonight is to help the community heal. Try to give them 2.5 hours just to come out and watch some football and get their minds off all the other events that are happening right now. And that's what we talked about in the locker room, is just let's go out and help our community heal.
South Umpqua High's homecoming celebration was canceled. Instead, during halftime, students read the names of the dead and released balloons into the sky. The school hopes to celebrate homecoming next week. Coming up in the second half of The Bridge, more healing and homecoming. We'll go to Astoria High School to see what preparations they're making for homecoming this weekend. Astoria High School has also suffered the loss of classmates this year. Students and faculty are hoping this homecoming will be the best one yet. We'll hear from student body officers and maybe catch a little of the band. But first, the Danish Maid is a favorite here on Commercial Street in downtown Astoria. When John and Jan Lindstrom, owners of The Maid, had difficulties after recent medical emergencies, friends, neighbors, and local businesses rallied to help out.
The bistro will donate a quarter of its profits October 17th to the Lindstroms. Johnson & Jensen have been gathering other businesses to donate. The Rusty Cup Coffee House will donate $1 per drink October 9th, and Pat's Pantry will donate a percentage of its proceeds during a book signing for Season from Scratch by Crystal Hood from 1 to 3 p.m. October 18th. Downtown Association Director Elena Garner said there is an effort to have more downtown merchants donate to the Lindstroms. This is Edward Stratton of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Local residents may have noticed that the Tourist No. 2, a ferry that shuttled riders between Astoria and Washington State between 1924 and 1996, did not visit Astoria last summer as some in the community had hoped. But take heart, the push to bring the 91-year-old vessel home from Bremerton is happening on two fronts. Captain Christian Lindt, the Tourist No. 2's owner, is waiting for a spot to open up at North Lake Shipyard on Lake Union in Seattle, where the U.S. Coast Guard would inspect the boat below the waterline and determine the repairs that must be made. Once everything checks out, Lindt will sail the ferry to Astoria before winter and moor the vessel at the city pier. The Coast Guard would then be asked to inspect the rest of the frame, and the community would have a chance to see the ferry and work out a plan to reclaim it. A new nonprofit, Friends of the Astoria Ferry, is forming to raise the funds and community support needed to buy it from Captain Lindt, fix it up, and maintain it. Though still unincorporated, the Friends group has 5 board members, including City Councilor Cindy Price. The group hopes to raise up to 7 to 9 members. Right now, their plan is to turn the Tourist No. 2 into a passenger boat for sightseers and a part-time charter service. During the fair weather months, the ferry would travel 3 to 4 miles along the riverfront and remain docked the rest of the year, though still open to the public. Occasionally, the ferry would be rented out to businesses for private parties and excursions. User fees would help keep the ferry staffed, insured, and operating in Astoria. The Tourist No. 2 is the last surviving Astoria ferry, a three-deck wooden hull ferry 110 feet long, 40 feet wide, 40 feet tall that can accommodate at least 185 people. For more than four decades, the vessel transported riders and their cars 4.5 miles across the Columbia River, a service that the Astoria Bridge rendered obsolete. You're listening to The Bridge on the stations of Coast Community Radio. A diverse coalition wants voters to have a say in the best way to fight climate change in Washington. On Tuesday, the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy announced a 2016 ballot initiative that says it could hasten the transition to a clean energy economy. One America is in the Alliance, and Executive Director Rich Stoltz says the Alliance believes it's critical to address pollution fueled by climate change in a way that protects communities and the economy.
It's the first time I've seen such a broad gathering of public health professionals, communities of color, businesses, labor unions. It speaks to the sense of urgency and the need to do something on climate, but to do it in a way that makes sense for Washington.
The proposal will build on the state's recently announced clean air rule by enforcing existing global warming pollution reduction targets, charging the largest emitters a fee for each ton of carbon pollution they emit. Stoltz adds the proposal will take into account the needs of minority, low-income, and frontline workers, as well as businesses in the move toward a cleaner economy by reinvesting revenue from the carbon cap into communities impacted by climate change. With threats including floods from rising sea levels and wildfire, Stoltz says Washington is feeling the effects of climate change in a multitude of ways.
Across the state, communities are facing the consequences of climate change now, and more than others, low-income and minority communities are feeling the brunt of that change.
Stoltz adds that a ballot measure will allow voters to decide how climate change can best be addressed responsibly.
It's the strongest statement that we can make as a state about our values with regard to carbon emissions, the environment, and our communities. This is a time when Washington's residents can take their own future into their own hands.
Initiative 732, also aiming for the 2016 ballot, would tax carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels while cutting other taxes by the same amount. But Stoltz contends that it and other recent proposals to address climate change fail to take into account the impact on health, community viability, and the difficulty people and businesses can face in the transition to clean energy. This is The Bridge here on the stations of Coast Community Radio. I wore blue velvet. No, I really did. And I had a white gardenia at my wrist, and my boyfriend was on the football team, and we'll leave those homecoming memories to the previous century, shall we? Astoria High School is among the many high school and colleges celebrating homecoming this month. The tradition of homecoming 21st century is very much all-American and commemorated in some way throughout the country. The annual Harvard-Yale game has been inviting alumni to return home for the game since the 1870s. The origins of the first homecoming celebration remain largely contested. Baylor, Illinois, and Missouri are three of the front runners, all having planned and held their first coming home celebrations around 1910. Despite the debate, these early homecoming events all had similar characteristics. A football game served as a center point. The events included rallies, parades, speeches, and dances. The event's intended to unite alumni and students to create a stronger sense of school pride, and they were wildly successful. Success is just what the Fighting Fishermen are hoping for this weekend, success on the field, and the success of drawing the student body, alumni, and the community together to celebrate and perhaps to heal a bit from a difficult start to the year when they suffered the loss of fellow classmates within weeks of each other. I spoke to Coach Howard Rube, who had this to say about the upcoming game and events.
We're packing a lot in during the week, and we have a lot of excitement. The kids are motivated. We hope a lot of alumni will be back for the game, and we're just excited about it.
Student body Clay Williams was in the leadership room. It was noisy and busy with markers, glitter, glue, and quiet talk and laughter as student body officers prepared all the necessary signs for a proper homecoming event.
The theme this year is Around the World, and that's where each individual class represents a country, and the seniors generally wear togas during the week. I think that's tradition across the country. So we're Greece, the juniors are France, the sophomores are India, and the freshmen are Canada.
I had a great morning with the students of Astoria High and got more material than we could air on the show. But we will be back. To all alumni returning home or just reminiscing from home, enjoy this time. And to all senior class of 2016, we wish you a great year. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, a podcast is available on our website at coastradio.org. My thanks to Principal Lynn Jackson, faculty and students of Astoria High School, and thank you for listening. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.